Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure for me to be able to introduce Wayne Madsen, who I've wanted to get on the Salieri Report for the longest time. He is a Washington-based investigative journalist who publishes the Wayne Madsen Report, which I want to recommend. I've been a very satisfied subscriber. Whenever anything is going on that is complex and involves intelligence agencies, Washington, or just geopolitics globally, I always want to know what Wayne thinks. He's always got a unique, interesting take on things. He's got a deep background both in the U.S. military and intelligence community, having worked for the Navy, having worked for the NSA, and numerous other organizations connected. So this is somebody who really has an inside beat with a very powerful intellect, so understands the complexity and the networks involved. He's published numerous books. We're inspired to get him because of one of his two latest books, Soros Quantum of Chaos, which very much involves the dovetail of the U.S. intelligence and military community with the Wall Market, with Wall Street and the financial markets, which is our beat. Anyway, as I said, he's somebody I always want to know what Wayne thinks about what's going on. And I can't think of anybody better to explain the concepts of soft power, soft weapons, soft revolution, which is what we're going to talk about. So, Wayne Madsen, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Hi, good to be with you.
So, we have to start with, I was so delighted to see that you published something on Soros. We have to start with you explaining the title, Soros Quantum of Chaos. I'm someone who uses the James Bond movies a lot to explain phenomena going on. So if you could start off by explaining where the title Quantum came from.
Well, Catherine, you're right in using James Bond to explain a lot of these issues, because many people may or may not be aware that every James Bond script since the very first one was vetted by British MI6. The 007 franchise is much more than an entertainment venue for movie producers. It has always reflected the current thinking of the British, not only the British establishment, especially the intelligence establishment, but also the monarchy. And right. In the case of the title Quantum of Soros, the last three James Bond movies basically featured as the evil person the entity that was called Quantum. Now, that's interesting because the name of George Soros's hedge fund, the one that he had which tried to short the British pound in 1992, is called the Quantum Fund. This is no coincidence. This is not a mistake. The last movie, and this was all Daniel Craig as James Bond has been featured in these movies, where the evil entity that's trying to take over the world is Quantum. And in the last movie, Spectre, basically the head of Spectre outs himself to Bond, but he says, you know, all those things that you've experienced over the years, all the things that have happened in the world of a dastardly nature, has been caused by an organization that's even larger than Spectre, which is Quantum. And so this is where the idea to explain how Soros is involved in all these themed revolutions, color revolutions. What Naomi Klein refers to, and I think rightly, is disaster capitalism. I thought it was a good way to sum up the nasty and evil deeds of George Soros. He's much more than a Dr. Evil, because Dr. Evil is sort of a satirical takeoff on Bond villains. Soros is real, and he's a real evil man, and he's a real danger to the entire planet.
So let's talk. Let's step back and talk. What do we mean when we say soft power, soft weapons, soft revolution, soft warfare? Explain to us what this concept of soft is.
Well, this all came out of the teachings and writings of a guy named Gene Sharp, runs the Albert Einstein Institute up in Boston. He has denied for years that he's linked to the CIA, but, the CIA certainly uses his tactics. Now, in the past, we know what we talk about hard power. We saw that in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s in Latin America, especially, but all over the world. That's where governments were changed, tanks were rolled out into the streets. The local CIA stations would conspire with the military generals to overthrow the elected governments, and that was an exercise in hard power. But in the last several decades, we've seen a change, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, to ensure that these newly quote unquote independent countries were able to extricate themselves from their past. We saw Soros finance these revolutions that are basically street revolutions. They're themed, or they have a color designation. Now, that's not to say they don't turn violent. Certainly, in the case of the last Ukrainian revolution against their democratically elected president Yanukovych, called the Euromaidan revolution, that we saw a lot of violence. We saw a lot of people being killed, but the revolution started out as a mass street demonstration, and we've seen this happen in many countries. It's happening right now in Venezuela, but that one unfortunately has also turned violent. But it's started out with mass street demonstrations. We saw it in Brazil with the constitutional, quote-unquote constitutional coup that ousted President Rousseff. And we've seen it in Asia, in Myanmar or Burma. We saw the junta there basically ousted because of a popular revolution by the followers of Aung San Suu Kyi, who, by the way, receives a lot of money from Soros' Open Society Foundation. And we've seen it attempted in Russia and China. These are the two ultimate goals for the Soros practitioners of soft power revolutions. They eventually want to see the governments in Moscow and Beijing come under the jackboot, maybe a velvet jackboot if you're Soros looking at this, but nevertheless, they want to bring these two countries under the heel of the, for lack of a better term, the Western elites.
Now, how much of the sort of the soft tactics is made possible by satellites and the digital systems?
Well, we do know that Soros, especially when we look at the so-called Arab Spring movement, relied heavily on Twitter and other social media like Facebook to organize the demonstrations, basically communicate the memes or the themes of the revolutions. It started out, of course, with this a shopkeeper in Tunisia who burned himself in protest, and that just, no pun intended, spread like wildfire through right. Not only Tunisia but neighboring countries, and we see what has happened as a result of that. The civil wars in Libya and Syria went from being a soft power projection to being the old-fashioned military civil wars, and they've been horrendous with the number of lives lost and the now the Muslim migrant invasion of Europe as a direct result of what happened in Libya and Syria and the resurgence of the rebellions in Iraq. So,
right.
This was the effective use of social media. Now, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, she advocated this. She had people on her staff that were Soros veterans who were working with the Soros non-governmental organizations to bring these rebellions about. And I would also note that her personal assistant and close friend, Huma Abedin, whose mother has links in Saudi Arabia, the Muslim Brotherhood, was one of the chief advocates for what occurred in Egypt. And we know that there was the counter coup against the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, which has turned that country into basically a military dictatorship.
It's very interesting. There was a chart that one of the money managers put out a month or two ago that I've used a lot in my presentations.
It showed
that the GNP of women globally plus the GNP of the United States is bigger than China and Asia. And my perception is that playing the women's card is a very important part of the soft revolution. And so a Clinton presidency is part of that. It's part of, we'll talk about the Clinton Foundation in a second, but it's all part of making this look fluffy.
Well, yes, and if you see what's going on in Latin America right now with the United States, the Obama administration, pushing the Argentine foreign minister, Macari, to be the next secretary general of the UN. She'd be the first female secretary general of the UN. But the ramifications of that, she is the foreign minister for a fascist government that won in a very dubious election against the party of former President Cristina Kirchner. So even amongst women leaders, we see this huge difference between the likes of Macari, who hopes to be the next Secretary General of the UN, who's already undercutting her former boss. She used to work for Ban Ki-moon, and now she's out there talking about what, you know, that he hasn't done a great job as Secretary General. I imagine we'll probably hear Hillary say the same things about Obama if she replaces him. But Angela Merkel is the other one. So we see a huge difference between the Merkels, Macari's, and Hillary Clinton's, and the Rousseffs of Brazil and Kirchner right. in Argentina, who were definitely not playing along with the international global elites. Neither one of these two ladies would ever have been invited, for example, to the Bilderberg meetings, which is taking place right now this week in Dresden.
It's very interesting. The Financial Times just published an interview with James Baker, a lunch with James Baker. Just wanted to read you a couple quotes. Quote, Hillary Clinton was never given anything to do. She was just there at the State Department to run for president, says Baker. I won't get my panties in a wedge because of what I'm hearing from the political candidates. What they say in the campaign and what they do once they're in the White House are not the same thing. I don't care who wins, whoever gets to the White House. Presidents can do a lot, but they can only do so much through a system of checks and balances. Basically, what he's saying is Clinton will do what we tell her to do.
Yeah, and I think that's, I agree, you know, I don't often agree with people who, you know, worked in the Bush administration, but I have to agree with Baker, even though I don't like agreeing with him.
Right.
Commentary on the way the world is. But isn't it always been the case that even if Trump were to be elected, you know, they always said that it's the office that makes the person. Well, they used to say the office makes the man. I'm dating myself here, but nowadays the office would make the person, and not the person. The person doesn't make the presidency. The office of the presidency basically changes the person. And I think, you know, that gets back, like, the president's really not in charge. And how many times and how many movies have we seen, fictional movies, where, you know, the president will have a line like, or somebody will be talking about the president like, you don't really think he's in charge, do you? I think even Nixon, well, Nixon actually said that when he, in that bizarre episode, when he, during the anti-war demonstration, when a bunch of anti-war demonstrators were camped out at the Lincoln Memorial, and he decided, like during the night, to take his limo over with the Secret Service to talk to them. And he was telling one of the, well, a couple of the protesters, he said, well, you know, it's not that easy for me to pull out of Vietnam. And one of the women protesters said, "You're not really in charge, are you?" And he said, "He said, no. Yeah, it's something like." So anyway, he said, "Like some, it's something like that."
Okay, so let's go to George Soros, and we should presume some of the listeners aren't really familiar with Soros and his operations, but maybe if you could introduce George Soros and who he is and what he's been up to for the last couple decades.
Well, back in the late 90s, he was featured in a 60 Minutes interview conducted, I believe it was by Steve Croft, who asked him about his past with his father at the end of World War II in Hungary, his native Hungary. And he said that he and his father avoided being targeted by the Gestapo because they cooperated with the Gestapo. And one of the things they did was to round up Hungarian Jews for the deportation of the camps. He helped the Gestapo gather, him and his father gather up their valuables to be turned into the Gestapo. And in the interview, he was asked, "Do you have any regrets about doing that?" And he, with a straight face, he looks in the camera. He says, "No." So this, I think, is the kind of person he is. I mean, a person who claims to be Jewish has no regrets in cooperating with the Gestapo, along with his father, and at the end of World War II. I mean, this is not a nice person we're dealing with. I don't care how much he claims he gives to charities. These are charities that he operates, and this is not like helping to feed the local homeless at the food kitchens. What he does is fund opposition political parties. He wanted to influence Human Rights Watch, so he basically bought it for a donation of $100 million. So now we see, I used to work with Human Rights Watch. I used to work with Amnesty International. They're nothing like they used to be because they're now under the heavy financial influence of George Soros. They'll point out the problems in the same, you know, the same countries that the CIA and State Department are targeting for disruption, but they won't point out issues in other countries, for example, the United States. Soros seems to practice the old Hegelian dialectic practice of funding both sides of an issue to create dissension. He's contributed money to Black Lives Matter, and he's given money to more legitimate political organizations, but it's not only to buy influence, but to really maintain his influence by having various groups pitted against one another. And this is the old, obviously, this is the old Marxist Hegelian dialectic in action.
So I want to tell you a couple of my personal Soros stories to give examples of how this works, because I've watched it work. And it's just stunning to me. So from 1995 to 2006, I was embroiled with, sort of an enemy of the state, brouhaha with the Department of Justice and the U.S. government. And in 1998, no, it was the fall of 1997, they basically came in, it went from then to spring of 98, where they seized our offices. Really, I mean, it was very illegal. The courts let him do it, but we had Sporkin as our judge, who was the former general counsel of the CIA, yeah, who was a real piece of work. So you can imagine how much fun it was having dealing with Sporkin. Anyway, yeah. So Sporkin's overseeing this, and he lets him seize our office. And we put up with just, a very ugly process. It took us about a week to get control of the offices back. We were able to get our main servers back and hide them at the law firm, and we were told by the Department of Justice staff, you're not allowed to have copies of, you're not allowed to have your own servers. We have orders that you may not have a copy of any of the knowledge and information.
Too bad Justice wasn't as hard on Hillary Clinton about having her own
server. So anyway, but we're in the middle of this thing, and a group of guys who I used to work with from Global Business Network, who were very close to the CIA, show up and suggest that, it's always the royal we. We've discussed your situation, and we think you should apply to George Soros for a grant.
Hmm.
And continue to do your work as a not-for-profit. Well, Soros at the time was on the executive committee of the Council on Foreign Relations, and it
took me about 5 seconds to realize, oh,
I've just had millions of dollars stolen from me. I've had all my equity stripped, and the people who stripped it are turning around and taking a small amount of what they've just stolen to use to buy me back. I would be, they're buying me back with my own money.
Right. Yeah.
And I looked at them and I said, I don't think so.
the essence of viper capitalism, yeah.
Right. So that's when I figured Soros or his syndicate was making a lot of money at mortgage fraud. Because the problem with what was in my databases was I was making the data accessible about mortgages guaranteed by the U.S. government, which it turned out at the time were many multiples of the houses existent in the country, which is the problem.
Right.
Anyway, so then the second thing was I started to investigate. In the mortgage fraud, Wayne was laundering, I believe, a lot of the narcotics trafficking and that the intelligence agencies was bringing in, and this got caught up in the Dark Alliance story. So I started to research the narcotics trafficking in MENA, Arkansas, and in South Central LA, and contiguous to the portfolios where there was big HUD and FHA mortgage fraud. So I'm just following the trail of the money back into the narcotics trafficking. And so when 9/11 happened, I published sent an email saying this is a bunch of hooey. And Al Giordano at Narco News said, can I publish it? And I said, sure. And it got a lot of attention. He came back and he said, I would like you to write an article on narcotics trafficking. And I said, but Al, I don't know anything about narcotics trafficking. I'm just trying to figure out how the money works on the HUD fraud. And he said, well, because you're a money person, you know a lot more than you think. So just write a series and I'll help you edit it. So I wrote a 3-part series called Narco Dollars for Dummies, which it became so popular, Wiley Publishing made us change the name to Narco Dollars for Beginners. Well, a process began. Basically what I was saying is, that this is there's an intimate connection between people like the Bushes and the Clintons and narcotics trafficking.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
certainly.
So a process began where this article just went electric globally. It was being translated into German, Italian. Legislators were reading it, all sorts of stuff. And I started being attacked by people who were in the war on drugs community. Mm-hmm. You would have thought they would have embraced me or something. And no, suddenly, who was it? Edelman was attacking me and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, so Giordano tried to broker being in the middle. And he ended up on the email with like 20 guys from the war on drugs community, all of whom were attacking me. And he was defending me. And he sent me an email from their discussions, and what it all came down to was they thought I was going to try and get their Soros money away from them. I'd try and get money from Soros, and it turned out they were all funded by Soros.
And Soros is officially for legalization of most drugs.
Well, but here was the thing. All of them were absolutely refusing to look at how the money works on the drug business and where the money was going and how it related to the cost of capital in Silicon Valley or Wall Street or anyplace else, which is patently absurd. But they were basically preventing disclosure. They were attacking. The LaRouches had published a book called Dope Inc., which was at least a legitimate effort to sit down and say, how does the money work on narcotics trafficking?
Well, he was faced with the same issue on charged with the wire fraud, mail fraud back by
right.
George H.W. Bush, and they experienced a raid of their offices. And
right. The LaRouches went through essentially what I went through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they
and so did
they
and
tried.
So did the good Reverend Moon. Only when the paper, the Washington Times, started to go after underage children being trafficked through the White House,
right.
And old Reverend Moon found himself in prison when Bush
right.
was president, and then when Bush decided to get friendlier with Moon, and Moon invited him to speak at some Mooney functions, and it was all lovey-dovey again, But
right.
Yeah, and it's quite obvious how the Bushes operate.
So the second time was, so I wrote back to everybody with Al's permission saying, look, you all keep Soros' money. Where I come from, I can't be legitimate if I take money from Soros. So I would never destroy my brand by taking money from Soros. Thank you very much.
Right.
But that was it for me in the war on drugs community. And then the third time, I published a paper in London about Real Solutions, how we could create vehicles to finance place-based equity as opposed to just corporate equity. And I got a request from a group, it was either in Tibet or Mongolia, who was funded by Soros, asking me if they could publish it and translate it into their language and publish it. But they wanted to know that they would get the copyright. And I said, no, I would continue to own the copyright. They would just have a license, and then they disappeared. And I never quite understood what that was about. But what the three sort of circumstances said to me is Soros is making money in the markets. My guess is he's making money with the help of inside information. And the people feeding him that information then want him to put it in foundations that are used strategically to enhance the syndicate's control.
Yeah,
and that's
what it looks like
to me.
And I think he obviously he's got a very close relationship with the CIA. He's taken over from the CIA the functions and effective control of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which is now based in Prague, and it works. They work very closely with some of his other operations like Central European University in Budapest. But basically what happened is Eastern Europe and Central Europe traded the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact domination for the domination now of George Soros.
Right.
If you're a leader, now a case in point is Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who's come out now not only against NATO and the European Union and against open borders and mass migration, but he was originally one of Soros's acolytes. And now he's not only broken with Soros, he accuses Soros of trying to overthrow his government in Hungary.
Right.
I just wonder, if people are more know that they've been used, like Orban obviously knows he's been used, how many more cases we will have of the countries that are pathetically now under the domination, which I think is even more oppressive than what they experienced under the Soviet Union, because even though there might have been some semblance during the Cold War that they were not independent totally, their culture and their nationhood wasn't at stake like it is now as part of the European Union, and having to accept migrants of percentages and for some countries like the Baltic countries could absolutely change their culture around because they're such small countries with small populations. But I think when Soros said that Europe can take in millions of more refugees, this is what he has in mind. He wants to see the cultural destruction of Western civilization. And I mean, just yesterday there was an incident in the south of France where two Muslims beat up a woman, a French woman who was serving drinks in a bar because it's the first day of Ramadan. this is the type of thing, situations that Soros thrives on, because then he funds groups that'll go out and protest, any groups in France that'll protest against what these two Muslim guys did. This is pure.
Is there any proof yet as to who's financing the travel costs and cell phones for the groups, for the refugees moving north?
They do definitely have. They have debit cards. They have cell phones. They have.
Right.
Now, whether it's from Soros, I don't know. But we do know that a lot of the funding comes from the Erdogan government and groups in Turkey that are in bed with Erdogan. I would note that just a few months ago, Soros held a meeting of his operations in Istanbul, and Erdogan was present at this meeting of Open Society foundations and other related groups, and not once did George Soros criticize what Erdogan is doing in Turkey, which is basically destroying any semblance of democracy and secularism that country's ever had. Now, isn't it funny that Soros was very silent because, obviously, you know, Soros and the CIA are—I feel they're one and the same. And the CIA and Brennan support these jihadist governments in Ankara and in Riyadh and in Doha, and this is all part of the destabilization process of the Middle East and increasingly in Europe.
What's the goal of destroying Western civilization? What's the goal of really? I mean, when you come into Italy, spent a fair amount of time in Europe last year. I'll be there again in July. When you come into Italy, when you come into the Netherlands, you just see, you know, the traditional cultures feeling very overwhelmed. What's the goal of that?
I think it's to prepare the world for, this global government, a world without borders. It's a psychological thing going on here, just I think to prepare people. And of course, nationalism is something that Soros finds anathema to his own goals. I would note that you would think that Soros, being a liberal, would have supported the Scottish independence referendum, for example, because the Scottish National Party is a fairly liberal party. It's basically the old Scottish Labour Party, and he did not. He supported the No campaign for Scotland to remain within the United Kingdom, just like he's obviously supporting the No campaign on the Brexit coming up on June 27th. So I would also note that his father, Tivdar Soros, was one of the prime movers and shakers behind Esperanto. This was this idea that the world would have this one common language, and they borrowed a little bit from not every language, but the major languages. And that, of course, didn't really go anywhere. Went the way of the pet rock and the hula hoop as far as fads went. But it was a serious thing back in the 30s and the 20s when Soros's father was really pushing for it. So when I mentioned Soros and his father both helping the Gestapo in Hungary, Soros's father was well known by that time to the Gestapo as the guy that was pushing Esperanto. By the way, Hitler was totally opposed to Esperanto as a program. Right. Didn't like that idea whatsoever, but the Gestapo didn't mind dealing with Tivadar Soros, George's.
Soros
by the way, the real name was Schwartz. They changed the name. Yeah, it's Tivadar Schwartz.
Soros was very much on the other side of Bush. He and the Bushies had a lot of hostility towards each other. Is that right?
Yet Soros was one of the initial investors in George W. Bush's Arbusto Oil Company, which went bust. He was a $1 million investor. As a matter of fact, so was Salman bin Laden, the older brother of Osama bin Laden. Soros has been a mover and a shaker for quite some time. But there seems to be these issues every once in a while where the elites have sort of like family spats, quarrels inside the behind the big marble door, and sometimes they come out in the open.
So I wanted to bring up the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation because we're really part of, I think, the soft revolution is making invasions look like you're helping. And we're seeing both the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation, you know, equally do their own sort of strategic control damage, just like the Soros philanthropic interests.
Right.
But you say it's all part of the same model?
In some sense, it is. I would, one of the most egregious things that the Clinton Foundation has been involved with is the beleaguered country of Haiti.
Right.
Now, this is a country that was poor anyway, and it's just a basket case. No thanks to anything done by the Clinton Foundation or Bill Clinton. Haiti used to have a very vibrant rice industry, agribusiness. They were self-sufficient. They produced so much rice, as a matter of fact, they were able to export.
Right.
Clinton, who comes from a rice-producing state, Arkansas, that produces this worthless rice that you find in minute rice. It's bleached. It has no nutritional value. Basically, oversaw the destruction of the Haitian rice business. Now, this was all done through U.S. Agency for International Development, and a heavy dose of Soros money was involved with that, too. Haiti today is an economic basket case, especially after the earthquake, which they have never recovered from. Recall that Clinton and George W. Bush both went to Haiti to, help raise money for donations. Nothing has happened. People are still living in squalor, and some of Hillary's cronies are doing quite well in Haiti, but that's the elites who are basically paying substandard wages to these poor people down there. And Haiti is, if I were running a legitimate campaign against Hillary Clinton, I would actually point this out about Haiti would be the example. Oh, she thinks she did a good job as Secretary of State? Well, let's forget what she did in Libya and Syria. Let's just take a look at Haiti and this country that is much worse off now after Clinton was Secretary of State. And no thanks to her husband either, who's as big a crook as she is. But that's just one example where we saw the Clinton Foundation in action.
It's very interesting because I've made an effort to try and understand what's been going on in Haiti. I just reviewed Dr. Cherry's book, We Dare to Be Free, and she's going to be on the Salyer Report in a couple weeks. And if you look at the models of how they've busted Haiti,
The black people in the U.S. used to call it the beatdown.
But if you look at sort of how they've organized the beatdown on Haiti, it's not unlike what they're doing to the United States in a more subtle way. You basically use federal regulation and sort of import things to bust the small farmer, and that creates a pool of urban labor that you can then use in labor camps to do cheap offshoring, and then you strip mine the natural resources. In Haiti's case, one of it was a gold mine. So, it's not unlike what you're doing in the United States. It's interesting. In 1998, the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington brought in some women from Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia to lobby the Congress about the war on drugs and what was going on there. And I went over to meet, I was just an interested party. So I went to listen to their presentation before they went over to Congress. And I started to ask them about, they were being moved off the land into the cities into subsidized housing. So I started to ask them, all these questions about how the money worked, you know, who was making money on building the housing, who was picking up the land. And finally, the woman from Peru looked at me and she says, "Senora, you say you know nothing about our countries, but you know everything about our countries, you know," and she was very suspicious looking at me. And I said, "Well, I know nothing about your countries, but I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing. And apparently the model in your countries works exactly the way it works in this country."
Yeah.
And what I hadn't...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're right about Haiti. The destruction of the rice and other agriculture forced people to move from the rural areas into Port-au-Prince, into the slums. So when the earthquake struck, you had more people living in the cities than the buildings could actually hold. That's why the death toll was so great. It was a direct result of the destruction of the rural way of life and the influx of people into the cities. And, of course, then they were prime candidates for working in the U.S.-owned textile mills for next to nothing, including child labor, I would add. And I may be one of the few journalists who I was in Ferguson, Missouri, actually right before the shooting there and the rioting and the demonstrations, because I was actually on my way back from by car from the Eisenhower and Truman libraries where I was doing some research. I just happened to have stopped in Ferguson and stayed there overnight, and I noticed that the town was blighted, and the reason being is if you know, St. Louis, like every other major city, all the major employers that had employed people in that area had gone out of business. The jobs had been sent overseas, and the only major employer is, you know, this was for Ferguson, is Lambert Field, the airport, St. Louis International Airport, which is right next to Ferguson. And you know, this is a town that exists based on a single employer, basically, the airport, which is all service-related, jobs that don't pay very much.
My squabble long ago with the federal government was I was creating vehicles that would significantly lower the cost of capital to small business. Because so much was being done from a regulatory basis to increase the cost of capital and shut the flow of capital up to off equity capital, and that was, I think, part of the fight, because the effort to shut down sort of access to capital by small business has been extraordinary. And you know, and that's part of what's devastating communities like Ferguson, because when you think about it, new technology is very decentralizing. It should help the small guy much more than the big guy, but it hasn't turned out that way. Well, let's talk a little bit about there have been some extraordinary whistleblowers on the digital sort of technology and how that's compromising sovereignty, whether it's individual sovereignty or national sovereignty, in a variety of ways. And I'm referring to Drake and Snowden and WikiLeaks. How does what's going on with Soros relate to those whistleblowers?
Well, I don't think there was any, at least I haven't detected any links between Soros and Snowden or Drake, who I know Drake. I was well aware of his trials and tribulations long before he got in trouble with the FBI. Now WikiLeaks is an interesting one, because while I never thought that the disclosure of those State Department cables was amounted to much, I think the disclosures of what Hillary Clinton was sending on her private server was much worse for national security, because in essence, what the State Department was doing, they were overclassifying information that was based on the translations of local newspapers in other countries, the content of cocktail party conversations, diplomatic receptions. Well, this should have never even been confidential. But a lot of it was made secret. And I got into a big argument over at the Arab Media Forum, where I was invited to speak as one of the American journalists. I got into an argument with the editor of Le Monde, who they had entered into an agreement with Julian Assange and published some of these documents, and of course she was saying, "Oh, we think it was a very, very important disclosure." And I'm saying, "Yeah, if you're into cocktail party gossip, I guess so, but it's not, and really nothing to do with national security." And I noticed all the, especially the Arabs in the audience, were nodding in agreement with me and disagreeing with the editor of Le Monde. Let's take another case, not the State Department, where WikiLeaks disclosed all these sensitive documents from the bank Julius Baer, a very old private bank in Switzerland. The bank got into so much many problems as a result of the disclosures, it became subject to a hostile takeover bid by whom? Mr. Soros. So here is an example of, I believe, a WikiLeaks leak was done to damage the reputation of a very old bank in Switzerland, Julius Baer, and then unfortunately their chief executive officer, I believe he was one of the many Swiss bankers recently who committed suicide. That's just one example of the insidious nature of Soros's being a benefactor to groups like WikiLeaks.
Right. Now, Russia seems to have withstood the soft revolution. They, so far financial sanctions, if anything, a boomerang. So Russia seems to be an example of someone who's standing up to this, and they're clearly working to make their digital systems independent of ours for obvious reasons.
Yeah, so I think, basically, Soros and Hillary and Obama need to take a look at history. Whether you get mired down in the Russian steppes during a winter in an invasion like Charles XII and Napoleon and Hitler tried to do, or whether you try to do it in a more nuanced manner, you're going to face the ultimate backbone of the Russian bear. And Russia will not go down easy, as you say. And now there's a lot of opposition inside the European Union to these continued sanctions. Crimea was part of Russia, and it was Nikita Khrushchev in 1954 that gave it to Ukraine as a gift, like it was his to give away. So what we're supposed to now accept is the fact that a map change conducted by the leader of the Soviet Union is supposed to be recognized as international law. It's funny, all these neocons who who were at the forefront of the Cold War against the Soviet Union now want to accept the fait accompli conducted by the Soviet Union. But that's just the nature of the neocons. They are true political chameleons, and at heart, they are what their parents and grandparents were, Trotskyites.
Right. Now, China also seems to have been resistant, and which is remarkable given that China has such a challenge keeping their population employed under the current circumstances. How is China doing in this?
Well, we saw Soros try to take advantage of China by starting up some demonstrations. It was called the Umbrella Revolution. Here we go back to the theme group in Hong Kong, which is because of its different system of government, which China recognizes, is a potential soft spot for China. And we saw basically China nip that one in the bud. We don't hear much now from the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong. China does exercise now a lot of quiet pressure in Hong Kong not to go too far. But now with this new president of Taiwan, who is a member of the party that favors basically independence for Taiwan, which the Chinese won't accept under any circumstance. We see Soros now getting involved in Taiwan, just like he's been involved in Tibet with the Tibetan government in exile. Look, even after Soros dies, his children, Columbell, which is she's running this Tibet operation, and his son will continue on with this. So just, of course, Soros, if he's like Kissinger and David Rockefeller, will probably live until he's 103 or 4. So we may be dealing with him a lot more for a lot longer time than most people would, envisage. But China, from what I understand, and I talk to the Chinese and obviously, I talk to them so much it's got me a visit from the FBI because they must think that I'm giving away state secrets like I have any. But the Chinese are on to them, and they're keeping close eye on these groups, NGOs. You know, Putin in Russia is basically now forced a lot of NGOs to either register. If they don't register with the government, to get out. He's thrown a lot of Soros operations out of Russia. And I think the Chinese won't let it get to that. They're just not going to let them in.
One of my concerns watching, particularly the ones in Hong Kong, is that entrainment technology and subliminal programming working through the smartphones and the social media is very much part of what's happening.
Right. And of course, although there is a physical line of demarcation between mainland China and Hong Kong, I mean, you can't just go back and forth without going through some, customs and immigration control. That doesn't affect, social media, which doesn't recognize any borders at all.
Right.
And one of the odd things about Hong Kong is it's so expensive to live in Hong Kong now. A lot of people who work in Hong Kong who are expats, and there's many of them in Hong Kong, have now moved into mainland China, and they commute back and forth because it's a lot less expensive.
Really?
Yes. This is, and of course, with them, with their daily commute, they bring all their social media and whatnot with them. So the line of demarcation, thanks to the expats, between Hong Kong and the surrounding Guangzhou region is getting a lot blurrier than in the past.
Right. One of the comments you made in the Soros book is you talked about the ultimate goal of the
G7 being, and the Soros Alliance being, the division of Russia,
Indonesia, and China into smaller nations. Maybe if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, although Soros is not in favor of secession, that's where it would affect his interests. So he doesn't like, for example, the idea of Scotland breaking away or Britain leaving the EU or Catalonia leaving Spain. But that's not to say he doesn't look at secession as a means to extend control eventually over countries like Russia, China, and Indonesia, which are vast countries and have a lot. And a lot of people think that China, for example, is a homogenous country. It's not. It's got many, many ethnic groups. Many, of course, they speak Han Chinese, but they also speak their own languages. So this is ripe for Soros because one of the things that you see with Soros, for example, in Russia, is that he funds a lot of these groups in the Caucasus that are not only jihadists, but also they're favoring independence, whether it's Chechnya or about 20 other groups that are in that region that would like to break away from Russia. Now you multiply that across 11 time zones, and you've got potentially Russia could be, if it were to go the way of Yugoslavia, which Soros wanted to do also, you could have 80 to 85 countries from Russia alone, and China potentially 12. Indonesia, because you're dealing with over 1,000 islands, that could also be quite a mess there too.
Well, presumably, if you can get the Western world to continue to centralize control, and then you can fracture the emerging markets, then it makes it easier for the West to dominate.
Well, that's true, and we saw that with the CIA and Soros in Latin America when they were confronted with Evo Morales in Brazil. What did they do? They started to back secessionist movements in Bolivia, particularly in three states. With Korea and Ecuador, we saw a secessionist movement start up on the coast in the port city of Guayaquil, and in Venezuela with the oil-rich state of Zulia. When we were dealing with Chavez, we tried secessionist movements there. So this is obviously a tactic that has been used in the past, but it's not to say that there aren't these minority groups don't have rights and grievances. They certainly do.
Right.
But what was
right.
going on in Bolivia, for example, was the states where the secessionists were active were where the white Europeans were in control. So here we have white Europeans are saying we're aggrieved when they've been subjugating the indigenous population of Bolivia for centuries now. Now all of a sudden we've got white Europeans claiming their rights are being violated, and the U.S. is supporting. And oddly enough, and Obama continued with this supporting a white secessionist movement in Bolivia, believe it or not, against the native Bolivian president, Evo Morales.
So we've seen the same kind of divide and conquer politics and financing here in the U.S., and my question is the goal to break up the U.S. as well?
Well, I don't know whether that would happen geographically, as we see with other countries, or just socially, social schisms.
Right.
But definitely, I saw that during the Occupy Wall Street movement. There was absolutely an attempt, and I witnessed this personally, having covered the Occupy Wall Street. There was an attempt by Soros people to basically take over the Occupy movement, to do things in one case in Washington, D.C., at the Occupy encampment there, right on Pennsylvania Avenue. They were getting the campers, occupiers, so to speak, were getting water donated to them by local restaurants who kind of breed with them to some extent. And then all of a sudden here comes somebody from a Soros-run organization, that would be a labor union, but Soros influenced, and said, hey, look, we'll give you all the bottled water you want if you just go over and to Capitol Hill and support this. It was some initiative Obama was on jobs or something. They wanted the Occupy people just to transplant themselves down here to get some numbers for the cameras to support an Obama initiative. A very, very cynical move by Soros. Now, I have to say they put it up to a vote. And not only did they vote no, they asked the person who came over to leave. The Soros guy.
Well, you do get the sense that the body politics is getting smarter.
But for every example like that, how many were there where, the Soros people weren't successful in co-opting,
right.
For example, Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter or, I see on the other side of the spectrum, people like Rupert Murdoch doing the same thing with the Tea Party movement and, the right wing.
Well, it's really funny. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I was good friends with the guy who ran the property disposition for the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation. And we went through a period where the low-income activists were just screaming bloody murder about what was going on at the Resolution Trust Corporation. And then all of a sudden, the headline stopped. It just went silent. And I
right.
saw the guy at a meeting about a month later. I said, hey, what happened? All the activists suddenly went deep silent running. What happened? He said, oh, no problem. He said, I slapped out a couple of TA contracts to him. He says, they'll shut up for $25,000.
Yeah, every person has their price, right?
every person doesn't have their price, but
no,
it's amazing
true.
How much I was just, you know, like on the war on drugs thing, I was amazed, not that they sold out, but that they sold out for so little. That's what always amazed me.
Yeah, well, that was always the case with the KGB. They were amazed at how little these and I've talked to guys who were actually never defectors from any country are problematic. I remember talking to retired KGB colonels who were still getting a pension. They were professionals to the very end, even to the end of the KGB as we knew it. And they said it. Two things, he said. We anybody that ever tried to come into us and say we are a Marxist, we're American, we're communist, we agree with the Soviet Union, we'd like, oh, what's for this guy? This guy's a mental patient, right? why would they be saying this? And then they would sell classified material for so little. The money was almost like nothing. Like one guy from the CIA sold a manual for one of the spy satellites, $25,000. They couldn't believe it.
Right.
That it, you know, he got so little money. They said the guy could ask for more, and we would have paid him. But you know, he didn't want much more than that.
Americans have never been able to price their equity. What can I tell you? okay, so let's turn to the election, because certainly the election, as a form of entertainment, has been much more entertaining than. We would have believed. But what is Soros doing vis-a-vis the current presidential campaign?
Well, he's obviously supporting Hillary Clinton. He's always been close to the Clintons. This election is no different. But then again, I mean, it's not just that she has to rely on Soros. She's got some of the other deep pockets she can rely on in this election. But the issue now is trying to get a President Clinton control over the Congress, and with Trump really threatening the down ballot races for Senate and House and down to the governors and other races. I think Soros is probably doubling his efforts to make sure that happens.
Right.
That the Republicans are really routed in November.
Yeah, so it looks to me, you know, one of my theories has always been that Trump was being used to white out the Republicans so that the Clinton would really win and get control. Because the question is, how do you engineer someone like Clinton into the presidency with such high negatives? You've got to come up with
only,
a Republican who's
the
negative.
The only way,
yeah,
somebody a Republican who's like absolutely awful. And that's how it would be done. And there's many that have that, the same theory. And it's, I believe there's a lot of Republicans right now that who are in elected office who believe that Trump may have been a Trojan horse all along to ease Hillary into the White House.
Well, who is supporting Trump behind the scenes? There's no way to me that Trump could get this far without some support. Now, it just may be the people who want to see Clinton in the White House, but what do you know about
where Trump's
support is coming from?
Well, I've attended covered one Trump rally, and I was reminded of the Ross Perot campaign. Not certainly the candidates are not the same. Ross Perot, for all of his quirks and whatnot, I think he really had the interests of the United States in mind, the future of the country, because a lot of what he said in 92 came about. He said, you know, the jobs, the sucking sound of the jobs to Mexico, it happened. He was against NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Trump says he's against free trade, and then he changes his mind. Ross Perot never changed his mind, even when he ran again in 96. It was the same. He was the same thing. And but the people, I'm looking at the people now, obviously, they're not. Some are the same people. They're just older now. But even the younger people are like the people back in 92. They were frustrated. They didn't, you know, Bush lied to them, read my lips, no new taxes. They didn't trust Clinton because he was known as Slick Willie already in Arkansas. So they were really frustrated with the system. And we had a downturn in the economy, and they wanted change. And Ross Perot, I always said, right message? Probably not the right messenger, just because, you know, he didn't come across that well. I mean, I think he was well-intentioned, right. And I don't think he was a bad man. He's still alive. I don't think he is a bad man. But Trump, on the other hand, people are just as frustrated, maybe even more so, and they look to him. But, you know, unlike Ross Perot, Donald Trump is really not, you know, he's not, you know, can you imagine, for example, he doesn't exude any warm and fuzzy feelings. Ross Perot, for all, like I say, he was kind of a quirky guy, but, you know, you could talk to the guy, right? He wasn't a, but Trump, on the other hand, can you imagine if he were president, one of the jobs of the president is consoler in chief? And we, you know, even Obama, who's not a people person, has done that. Nixon did that, and he wasn't a people person either. You know, after the tornadoes, after the hurricanes, the earthquakes, they go, you know, look, can you imagine Trump being the consoler in chief? You know, I can't. I can't see anybody, you know, sitting on the remains of what was once their mobile home. This guy
I agree with you completely, but how in the world could we ever think of Clinton as a consoler in chief?
She'll have her husband do a lot of that. You know, he was always on that too. She will do it, but I think it will be with him in tow. You remember what he said this is a 2-for-1 deal, and you like me, you get hurt too. Right. And nothing's changed.
Right.
And to me, that's not a marriage. That's a corporation. That's a business arrangement. It always has been. Otherwise,
right.
It wouldn't have survived on both of their extramarital affairs. It wouldn't have survived. And I look at it, to me, it's like Sears and Roebuck. Even they fell apart after a while. But that's what it is. It's you get one, you get the other. And but I just don't see Trump exuding any warmth for people who have lost everything. You know, you think that, you know, the first thing you would say is you want to invest in, you know, take what little savings you have and invest in one of my operations here. You'll make a lot of money.
Well, I'm assuming what happens is that Clinton gets once they have Clinton get the nomination, Trump get the nomination, then they just arrange for Trump to lose support a little bit every week into the election, just enough to keep it entertaining.
Yeah, that is if we don't see some. I right now, you know, they're talk about a rebellion in Cleveland at the convention, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to see an election where the Republican Party is going to stand behind its Senate, House, and other candidates, and they're going to basically act as if Trump's not on the ticket. It'll be
Can they preserve the House and Senate under those circumstances?
I'm not certain. It's going to be difficult. I think they could lose the Senate definitely in this situation. They've got enough of a majority in the House. They might be able to eke out a majority there. But look, here again, we have a Speaker of the House who didn't even want the job. We had the former Speaker gone to jail for being a pedophile. So the House doesn't have a lot of respect right now either. So this could be, you know, they always said, you know, this is the year they're going to throw the bums out. And, you know, at the end is, you know, people, they vote their own bum, really like own bum, right? They say, well, he or she may be a member of Congress, but I'm not throwing that person out. But this may be the year where we see an anti-incumbency election like we've not seen since, what, 74 in reaction to Watergate?
So let me ask you a question, because I just did a review of Trafficking, Conchita Sarnoff's book on the pedophilia activities of Epstein, who Bill Clinton has been very close to. And when the book was first published, there was some...
Unfortunately, Trump has, too.
What? Trump was close to Epstein, too?
Oh, yeah. His name is in the Epstein flight manifest, and of course Epstein was at his Mar-a-Lago place in West Palm Beach, and Trump's been at his estate in West Palm Beach. Again, this is, you know, when you got that kind of money, these people tend to hang around a lot together. So
So one of the things I've been very intrigued about is we've seen Trump, as part of his tactic, you know, be willing to bring up issues that are very near and dear to a lot of Americans, like let's get rid of Common Core, or heavy vaccination schedules are a problem and maybe connected to autism, and saying things that are outside the politically correct spectrum. What are the chances that, you know, because the Clintons have an enormous amount of dirt on them, and I'm sure Trump does too. What are the chances that this election starts to really get into transparency about, you know, a lot of the bad habits of the American establishment?
Yeah, to use a Cold War phrase, mutually assured destruction.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I do think they have the goods on one another. I'm already hearing that, you know, the Clinton people are now prepared to look into Trump's, not only his real estate deals. Of course, they're the last people in the world to talk about failed real estate deals. Whitewater. But there may be some personal information coming out, especially Trump in the 80s in the Manhattan scene, Studio 54, which was a known drug place. Now, he said, Trump says he's never used drugs, or he's never used alcohol or drugs. Well, I don't know whether you could have even gone into Studio 54 without being exposed to drugs. I mean, it was that kind of place, and he was there quite a bit. And then now there's this new information about the relationship between Donald Trump and Roy Cohn. There's a blast from the past. Roy Cohn did a lot of work for Donald Trump and his real estate ventures. And Roy Cohn, when you're talking about dirty tricks, I mean, this was the counsel to Joseph McCarthy. Then became quite a notorious gay guy in Manhattan who did not hesitate to use blackmail to expose other gay people in those days. And so if we get down and dirty with Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton, I think the retaliation will be Roy Cohn and Donald Trump. The Trump people are going after Huma Abedin. You know, when I was in Washington, the word was at the State Department, don't, if you were a reporter covering state, do not bring up or don't ask anything about H&H being Hillary and Huma. And Huma, of course, is married to the disgraced former Congressman Anthony Weiner, who hoped to become mayor of New York, but was caught sending inappropriate photographs of himself out on social media. This is going to be a very nasty campaign, and I think it is going to get really dirty. And where if you had children, you would want them to watch HBO and turn off the news.
Right.
I think it's going to get that bad.
Oh, Lord. Okay, well, it's all part of the soft revolution of destroying Western culture, which we won't let them do. So,
I agree.
Turn off the news. But what they can do is they can turn on the Wade Madsen report. So if as we close, Wayne, if you could tell us a little bit about what you think we can do, including how we can find your website, your books, how we can subscribe, et cetera. Because I know you, whatever's going to be going on in the campaign, you're going to have the beat.
I'm supposed to cover the two conventions, but I've covered the conventions in the past, and I go where the PAC journalists don't go, and you know, in Philadelphia, by the way, in 2000 at the Republican convention there, I was interviewing people who were, you know, not there with all the what they call the press gaggle, and you know, I ran into the veteran Jack Germont at one of these offbeat things I was covering. So I try to do that with my own website. I try to pattern it after the muckraking of Jack Anderson and Drew Pearson before him, and guys like Jack Drummond, and he had a column for a long, long time in the Baltimore Sun. So the website, WayneMadsenReport.com, it's got a pay side, a subscriber side that keeps me going. I don't do advertising, so I'm not influenced by people selling stuff. And then there's a public side where people can read daily my pithy comments, which some people, especially in California, they say they can't have their first cup of coffee in the morning without reading the pithy comments about my take on
I never come to your website where I don't laugh. Sometimes I'm laughing so I don't cry, but I'm always laughing.
You know, it's sort of my – sometimes I think I'm channeling Andy Rooney with some of my comments on some of the news. I told
right, Andy Rooney on The Real Deal.
Yeah, if they ever need a replacement for him, I'm to the age now where I can actually qualify as a curmudgeon. But probably my take on things, I won't be saying, well, why do people keep all this stuff in their handbags and in their desk drawer? You know, my commentary would be a little bit more cutting and realistic. But that's why I would never be on a program like that. But anyway, I try to do that on a website. I've got another book coming out. It's my summer project. It's going to be a directory of CIA front companies, proprietaries, contractors, and partners since the inception of the CIA in 1947.
Oh, wow. That's going to be a long book.
It has turned out to be a lot bigger task than I imagined, because unless you sit down and start to collect them, you don't realize how many there's been over the years.
Right.
And it's like from one scandal to another. You know, we go, the JFK assassination, a bunch of front company, Bay of Pigs, the Guatemala in 1954, there was a bunch. And then we get into, Vietnam, Air America, and it's just a constant sort of a stroll through American scandals, and the CIA, of course, played such an intricate role in all those scandals, and I've long since forgotten about some of them. I mean, how could anyone forget about ITT in Chile and the names Harold Janine and Dita Beard? They were on TV every night, on the evening
right.
news. But I'm trying to bring back some of those, and it's sort of like a dictionary sort of format.
And if you could just mention some of your most recent books, including Soros Quantum of Chaos.
Yeah, another one is I call it Tales from the CIA Crypt, Political Assassinations over the several decades ascribed to the CIA. As a matter of fact, my story today, and this was one that I don't think is even in my book. I do a lot of research at the National Archives in the CIA files, those of which are readable because a lot of them are totally redacted. But some new stuff I got on Iran-Contra and the Tower Commission, and John Tower, who was supposed to be Bush's Secretary of Defense, but Bush pulled the rug out from under him. But that was after Bush and Tower actually clashed over the contents of the Tower report on Iran-Contra. Tower knew full
right.
well that George H.W. Bush was running that operation and said
right.
as much. The CIA and Bush were livid over his revelations in the Tower report. And when he died on April the 5th, 1991, along with his daughter in a commuter plane crash in Georgia, he was apparently writing a second book after his memoir, where he was going to name names about Iran-Contra, but he and his daughter were
right.
killed in the crash. And oddly enough, or ironically or suspiciously enough, the day before, April 4th, one senator who supported him for Secretary of Defense, he was voted down the first time a cabinet nominee had been voted down since 1959. Senate Intelligence Committee member John Hines died the day before Tower and his daughter died in a plane crash outside of Philadelphia, where a helicopter crashed into his plane in a mid-air collision. So the odds of that happening, two individuals who knew a lot about Iran-Contra, knew a lot about George H.W. Bush's role in it, dying in back-to-back plane crashes with only a few hours.
I've always believed the Bushies took Hines and Tower out.
I do believe that. And right. Just looking at some of the CIA files on that, they were afraid. They were absolutely afraid that was the conclusion people would arrive at. So, you know, the cover-up is, and you know what the CIA's, you know, and they did this ever since the questions about the Warren Report. You counteract any questions by calling the people who were making the questions conspiracy theorists. It's right there in the CIA document. We got to use this term as pejorative, conspiracy theorists. And it's been successful ever since.
That's why I proposed we use unanswered questions. You know, in the 9/11 group, we just said, you know, we don't know the answers, but it's government's responsible.
Right.
We're just going to ask questions. And that was
right.
Because as soon as you propose a theory, you're a conspiracy
yeah.
theorist. So instead you
right,
just keep...
Right, right. Yeah. Or if you say truth, you know, truth, 9/11 truth, that's turned into truther or even worse, truther. I mean, you get all these... Words are. This is all planned out in advance. How to strike.
It's all part of the soft weapons.
Yes, and it's a very
yes.
effective one. And
yep.
You know, I deal with that with friends of mine who are, you know, very well known published journalists. You know, we get the big New York publishers and whatnot. And their pat response to any of this is, oh, that's just conspiracy theory. Well, I think that's a deal they make a deal with the devil, sort of, in this case, that they will never entertain any conspiracy theories. And in return for that, they will get the nice big advances to do their nice little niche books on some. It seems to be the Civil War. Nixon's the big thing right now. Everybody's writing about Nixon, you know, that. For a long time, it was a Civil War. Then it was World War II. But yeah, that's how they get they get bought off. As we were talking about, people being bought off, and the only thing they have to do is to say they will always publicly admonish anyone who believes in any what they consider to be a conspiracy theory.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't. The great thing about developing something like the Salieri Report or the Your Wayne Mattson Report is all we need to do about making sure our subscribers have good information to make sure that they're happy, healthy, and understand what's going on. And we don't have to worry about any of these things. So anyway, Wayne, I want to very much thank you for joining me on the Salieri Report. This has been great. I'll keep you posted when we publish it. And, just keep up the good work, and if there's anything we can ever do at the Salieri Report to help you or support you, you just let us know. Okay?
Oh, thank you. Okay, good to be with you today.
You have a great day. Bye.
You too.